Eric Gower's most notable contribution to the Bay Area thriving culture of food and cooking has been so far his concept of the breakaway kitchen. I know that many of you are already familiar with this concept through his best-selling books and his cooking classes and seminars. And for those of you who are not in the know yet, I guess it could be summarized as simplicity, ease, and powerful flavors. It is a concept that Eric Gower brought with him from 15 years living in Japan and traveling throughout Asia, tasting, testing, experimenting, cooking, and exploring food markets all over. He has brought that with him, and this concept could not have found a more fertile ground than here in the Bay Area, where we are always embracing different cultures and their culinary traditions, and our own California culinary tradition of syncretism, as well as our belief in local, natural products to promote health and sustainability. These are all part of this concept of breakaway kitchen. And Eric has been back since 2002 and just finished writing his fourth book, The Breakaway Vegetarian Kitchen. Cook. Breakaway Vegetarian Cook. Has finished writing it and is now working on the iPad application. And as he was telling me, it's going to be the first iPad application for cookbook, kind of interactive.
Yeah, and then a full-on one. So almost all of the recipes the recipe will be lined up just like in a regular cookbook, and there'll be a nice photograph of the finished dish. But there'll be a small button that says, watch Eric makes this dish. And so I'll be actually demonstrating how to do it just on video. So we've videotaped tons and tons of recipes.
So hopefully this will be available soon. And
no. Oh, I wish, no. Springtime.
That's the springtime.
Yeah.
And he has now a regular column in the San Francisco Chronicle and has started a new venture, the Breakaway Matcha, that offers the world's finest ceremonial tea, green tea, I'm sorry. So tonight, Eric Gower will expand a little bit further on this concept and will tell us, is there such a thing as authentic cuisine? So please welcome Eric Gower.
Oh, thank you so much, Sylvie. It's really great to be here. I mean, the pleasure is so deep, I can't even tell you. I mean, if looking around, you walk into this place and you see some of the faces on the photographs, and you know, like the world's greatest religious leaders and philosophers and statesmen have all been here. And you know, if I thought about it at all, I would turn into a blabbering idiot because I'd be so nervous following in their footsteps. But it's really, really lovely to be here. I thought, before I get into like the main theme of the talk, which is I'm going to talk a lot about what authenticity means, and I don't think it means very much, to tell you the truth, in this world that we live in today, because the world is shrinking so rapidly that you know, everything is available from anywhere at any time. I mean, this is an amazing thought, right? Never in the history of humanity has this been true, but it's very true today. And this has tremendous effects for home cooks because it just opens up, you know, literally worlds of flavors that we didn't really have even, say, a generation ago. But before I get into that main theme, I thought it might be a little bit helpful to let you know kind of how I developed this way of thinking about food and give you this kind of whirlwind introduction about, you know, how it happened. And it basically happened in Japan. I started out studying, you know, this really lucrative career called modern Japanese literature, you know, all these jobs, high paying, you know. So what do you do with a degree in this language or this literature? And Sylvie has the same degree, I think. you don't do much. You go to Japan, and I thought I would go and kind of have an adventure and live there for a year and, you know, try to get the language really down. In university, they really teach you how to read quite well, but they don't really teach you how to speak because they're preparing you for a career in research, essentially. So they want you to read really well. So the reading I had kind of down. So when I showed up, people are just talking to me normally, and it's like, what in God's name are they talking about? So it took me a couple of years to kind of get that down, and I hitchhiked all around Japan and had all kinds of adventures. And I thought I would, stay a year, like I mentioned, but it turned into 2, and then it turned into like 5, and then it was 10, you know, and then it was 15, and then it was time to go after 15 for sure. I landed in Kyoto, the ancient capital, and I fell in with these lawyers, this wonderful group of lawyers who were trying to introduce the jury system into Japan. And they eventually did it. They did it last year. It took them about 20 years of really hard work. But they were a remarkable group of people. And they were my introduction into Japanese food. And so we would, we had a kind of study group that we did. And I'm not a legal scholar, but I did present some legal stuff for them to read in English because it was only in English. And I was helping them kind of try to understand it as best I could, working for the Osaka Bar Association. And after, we had been studying all day, we would go out and they would take me to these unbelievable places, and it was the beginning of my whole love affair with Japanese food, and they range from simple udon noodle shops, in all price points. I mean, that would cost $5 a bowl for this beautiful bowl of food, all the way up to these really elaborate 20-course what they call kaiseki meals, which are these super elaborate seasonally based meals that are really, really heavy on the visual. Like, they're really, really into the presentation. So they have these incredible visual displays on incredible handmade pottery, and it just keeps coming at you, right? So this huge range of eating experiences I was having like every day, and it was quite the introduction, into Japan. It was great for all those reasons. But then when I moved away from the city, I moved into this old country house. I did a brief sojourn back in California to go to graduate school. And then I went back, and this time I landed in Tokyo, and I lived there for a couple of years. And I was really getting kind of, Tokyo is a strange place. It's like 20 million people packed in a really kind of a tight area, and it can be very intense. So I was looking for a place outside the city where I could live, and I found this wonderful old Japanese-style country farmhouse, and it was a very difficult process that I would love to get into, but we're going to run out of time if I do. But at this farmhouse, I began to grow a lot of vegetables that weren't and food that weren't really available in Japanese markets. So I was growing chilies and herbs and stuff that, and this was the late 80s. So none of this stuff was available in markets back then. But in order to get all my other food, I had to visit my local Japanese market. And in the beginning, I really didn't know what a lot of this stuff was. I mean, it was all written in kind of, this cursive Japanese that, if you really deciphered it, you could do it, but you could figure it out. But even then, once you were able to read it, it really didn't tell you what it was or what to do with it. So I thought instead of learning, and I've always liked to cook. It started when I was pretty young. But I thought, do I really want to learn how to cook traditional Japanese food? And my answer was no, because I was just surrounded by so much of it, and I thought there's no real reason to kind of reinvent the wheel. So I was doing a lot of cooking at home, just kind of winging it, with stuff that I found in the market. And like I said, I didn't know what a lot of this stuff was. So I would bring it home, and I would buy basically everything in the market. It was just this tiny little market where I lived in this small town. And it was all kinds of stuff that, and I would let my palate tell me what it was instead of looking it up. I mean, there was no Google back then, and you just couldn't come up with, descriptions and photographs and everything else. So I would just take it home, have a huge pile of vegetables, either that I had grown myself or that I had picked up at the local farmer's market. They had some fabulous farmer's markets there locally. And I would just kind of, taste it and see what happened. And it turns out, I think, this was a pretty seminal moment for me, that this is a really, really good way to learn how to cook, because you're not relying on what's come before it. You're relying solely on your palate, right? And so my big, I guess, revelation was, you know, you could take these wonderful Japanese ingredients like, you know, if you go into a store and you want to get some miso, you're confronted with literally like 50 kinds of miso. I mean, it's pretty awesome. And if you want to get some pickled plums, some umeboshi, there's just like, you know, 40 varieties there. And so I would get all the stuff. I'd bring it back home, you know, all the shiitake and the few herbs that they do have, like there's this ginger called myoga that's just nothing like it. It's crazy good. They don't really have it here. There's one place that has it in Japantown, but it's expensive and hard to find. But, you know, so these relatively, to me at least, esoteric ingredients, I would bring home and I would kind of just make these really simple combinations of stuff. Like, you know, I like to roast chickens. And there was a neighbor that had a chicken operation, so I had a lot of eggs and chickens. And so I would just play with some of these things that I had bought. For example, I would take some of these, like a red gutsy miso, and then I would squeeze an orange into it, too, because it's the consistency of, like, peanut butter. It's very, very thick. But if you thin it out with something, and then you take that and you scoop it underneath, you separate the skin of a chicken from the meat, you know, just with your fingers, kind of do it that way, and scoop a whole bunch of this citrus-infused miso into the skin and then stuff the cavity with whatever citrus you've used. I mean, it turns out to be this amazingly great dish, right? But you don't really see that in a Japanese restaurant. And so that was, and I would do things like that. And a lot of tofu. There's some wonderful tofu there. And I would just do things like combine really great fresh fruit with olive oil and herbs over tofu, and maybe put some like pickled ginger in it as well. That's another really great thing to do. But you know, you couldn't really get that in a Japanese restaurant. But it was just kind of like these weeknight meals that I would whip up, and you know, it kept going. And I really like to cook, and I just kept going with it. And I was cooking one night for a friend of mine who's a writer, and he brought over his editor from a quite well known Japanese publishing house. And the editor loved the meal. He just thought it was great, and he commissioned a cookbook on the spot. He said, "Why don't you write a cookbook on these things you're doing with Japanese food?" And I said, "All right." And so he just commissioned the book, and I wrote it in Japanese, and it was called Eric's Kitchen. It was my first book, and that kind of like set the tone for what I was doing. And it had a kind of a crazy subtitle on it. And the Japanese publisher put on this subtitle without even telling me about it. The title was Erikson-chi no Daitokoro, which just means Eric's Kitchen. But the subtitle they put in English, you know, I don't know why. I mean, just to make it kind of like some way. In those days, having an English subtitle was kind of fashionable, and it still is in some ways. But the subtitle was New Home Cooking for Young Women and Other Busy People. So it was really aimed at like, and there was kind of this doughy-eyed picture of me on the front, you know. And so that book kind of, and it came out, and I did a little book tour and went around and gave talks and stuff, and it was fun, and I kind of forgot about it, you know. And at the time, I was working for the Prime Minister's office as kind of a glorified copy editor, essentially. Anytime a senior official goes abroad and gives a speech, I usually take a look at it, and it winds up in my email box, and I make some comments on it. And I was pretty involved in the political world in those days, and I went to graduate school and studied, you know, political science and stuff like that. But I was growing kind of more and more bored with the whole, like, Japanese politics world and spending a lot more time thinking about food and cooking food. And now this cookbook came out. But I really did forget about it and just kind of went back to work. But then an editor from Kodansha, which is a big English-language publisher in Japan, found that book through some review or something. And they asked me to write a book in English describing some of these methods that I was coming up with. And so he commissioned a cookbook on the spot. And I didn't have an agent, you know, nothing like that. So I wrote that book, and that book came out, and it was called The Breakaway Japanese Kitchen. And that's when I came up with this term breakaway. So it just means to break away from some culinary tradition. In this case, it was Japan. And again, I kind of, you know, the book came out and I got some good reviews, and the LA Times reviewed it, and you know, my mother couldn't have written a better review. I was really happy about it. But again, I'm still kind of working in this political world and working for the Bank of Japan doing stuff. And again, kind of forgot about it. So that was the second book. And at that point, I'd been in Japan a long time. It was like 15, 16 years. And I moved back to the Bay Area. I moved back to San Francisco. I really wanted to be back here. I was really excited by the whole food scene going on here, and I thought I could be part of it in some way. But not, again, as like a career, but I didn't know what I was doing, really. I still don't know what I'm doing. And so I began to frequent the world of ethnic markets in San Francisco. I mean, there are so many. I mean, you have these great Mexican markets. There are great Middle Eastern markets, wonderful Indian markets, you know, all the Southeast Asian markets, the Thai, the Vietnamese, all all this stuff. And I used the exact same methodology that I had that I did with the Japanese, you know, the breakaway Japanese kitchen approach, which was to basically blind taste unfamiliar foods, figure it out, are they salty, are they sweet, are they bitter, do they have lots of umami? I'll talk about umami in a sec for those of you who don't know what it is. But it turns out that this method actually works with any cuisine that's kind of daunting and unfamiliar, right? So I was just doing all these substitutions, playing with, and I would take things that I found at these ethnic markets, and I would go to the farmers markets every week around here, and to bring everything home and just make these simple dinners, just making these kind of combinations, and so that went on, and I got a phone call one day from New York. It was an editor from HarperCollins saying that she had at a company party, somebody had cooked from the breakaway Japanese kitchen and brought the dishes as part of a potluck. And she loved the dishes. I forget what they were, but they made an impression on her. And she said, you know, who are you and what are you doing? And I explained to her exactly what I just said. I said, well, I've spent a lot of time in Japan and I just moved back to San Francisco. And now I'm just enthralled with all the global stuff that's surrounding me. And I'm doing the exact same thing. And she said, wow, that's just a fantastic concept for a book. You know, let's do a book. So she commissioned, right? So this is the third one that got commissioned. I still don't have an agent. You know, I'm still not really seriously thinking about this as in any kind of like career way. But and so I wrote that book, and that book was called The Breakaway Cook. And that came out in 2007, I think. And that got some good reviews and stuff too. And then it just kind of kept going from there. But that's kind of how I came about, you know, with this notion of breakaway cooking. But what really kind of interested me was something, you know, slightly more theoretical in some ways. I think the central insight is that you can take some relatively daunting cuisine and really make it friendly for people who don't know anything about that cuisine, right? But you can't do it in a traditional way, and you can't do it in what most people would call an authentic way. You know, when we go out to dinner, all of us do this. You know, if we say, let's go get some Thai food or some Indian food, we often say, you know, what's the most authentic place you know? Let's go there. And for my money, for me, that's a very non-interesting way to eat, because we're all so familiar with all what's authentic and great about those cuisines, and why not go to some place that is pushing the boundaries just a little bit? And that's not really fusion. I don't like the F word very much, because of all the unfortunate experiments that went on in the 1980s in the name of fusion. I mean, there were just some crazy stuff going on, you know, and they called it fusion, you know, the cuisine. They kind of ruined it. But for people who just take these small borrowings, you know, from cuisines, like, for example, my favorite restaurant in San Francisco is probably a place called Aziza. I don't know if you guys know it, but it's this Moroccan place on Geary. And it is fabulous. The guy is from Morocco, but he doesn't really cook, traditional Moroccan cuisine. He shops at all farmers markets. He's obsessed with the local and the organic and getting the absolute greatest products that he can find. Yet he brings this complete Moroccan sensibility to these great ingredients. And there aren't a lot of restaurants around that do that. You know, it's kind of rare. So I highly encourage you to visit Aziza. It's really a great place. But this idea the authentic, I think that you're never really going to be authentic, really. Like, if you keep drilling down, like, if let's say, you know, you're in deep Italy somewhere in Umbria, and you're in this little village in Umbria, and you've heard about this particular, you know, authentic truffle dish, and this dish, you're not going to find this dish, or you'll find versions of it, but you're never going to find the real version of it, because there's going to be some grandma somewhere who's going to insist that hers is really the only authentic way to do this. And it's just kind of a losing argument. I mean, there's no way you can win this argument. So I think it's best not even to try. So, like, to give up almost on the idea of authenticity. Should great food, must it be authentic? Of course not. I mean, some stuff is authentically bad. I mean, I've had plenty of authentic food that's just terrible. I mean, but it could be improved somehow, right? And so that's kind of what I try to do. But I don't want to, like, poo-poo traditional food and traditional anything. The reason that traditions have legs, let's say, the reason they've stayed around so long is that they do make some kind of coherent and inherent sense, right? I mean, traditions got to be traditions because people in local areas before any kind of globalization, anything like that, what you have now, I'm going back not only centuries but millennia, really stuck within about 50 miles of where you lived and were brought up, and you didn't really travel very much, and what you ate was what people had figured out was not going to kill you, essentially, right? I mean, we're very good at surviving as human beings, and we have figured out, and we've passed down usually through oral traditions, and usually through women who have figured most of this stuff out, what is safe to eat, right? And when you really drill down, that's what a tradition is. We've kind of figured out what's safe to eat, how we can survive on a basic diet of something. And as we all know, depending on where in the world you are, this varies tremendously according to what's around us, right? So all these food traditions got to be that way just through just through a kind of stasis. But once globalization kind of happened, and you know, airplanes were built, and people started traveling, and well, way before airplanes, actually, just even any kind of motor, cars. Anytime you could get away from where you were and visit somewhere else, you brought back a little bit from something, right? I mean, it's a natural way that we've proceeded. But now we're in this kind of hyper overdrive. I mean, here we are in the year almost 2011. And the globe is shrinking almost by the minute. I mean, we have the internet now, and like I said in the beginning, every single food, basically from every single place on Earth, is available at any time. I mean, that's a remarkable statement if you think about it. That's never been true in the history of humanity. But we can order crazy foods from Vietnam or India just over the internet, and I do it all the time, and it's wonderful. But we haven't really taken this to its next big step. Like we haven't played enough, and I think the reason we haven't played enough is this idea of it's I think it's deeply encoded in our DNA that we're very careful about food, and that we want to eat in certain traditions because those people have figured out this is safe to do. I mean, I really think this is what's going on here, but. So I think what we really need to take full advantage of this this world that we live in is a kind of beginner's mind with food. So I found I have a new daughter. She's one. Her name is Daphne, and she has this true beginner's mind. Everything to her is new, right? Every single thing. Just the idea of learning how to clap or learning how to point or just, laughing at something or repeating or anything like that. She has this almost like blank light state, right? And it's fabulous. And I think that if you have this kind of beginner's mind with food, you can make all kinds of leaps that you wouldn't make otherwise, because if you're an expert in something, it's just a lot harder to have an open mind about things. But if you're a beginner in a kind of a childlike state, it's just easier, right? So, and the best way to go about getting a beginner's mind, in my opinion, is to do it through blind tasting. So you can really train your palate through blind tasting. If we, we're going to do this little exercise. You guys all have the blindfolds. I'm going to stop talking just in a few minutes here, but we've got some food up here that I've prepared, and it's the same food, but it's prepared in four different ways. And I just want you to put the blindfold on and taste each one. I'll tell you, there's even an order that I want you to do it. And you're going to think, how am I going to taste it in order for blindfold? There's a way. But through blind tasting, and this is how you proceed in the wine world as well. Some of you probably know a little bit about wine, but you will know this if you do, that the only real way to taste wine is to taste it blindly. I mean, if you're looking at a label, you figure it out, and you've got all this kind of information coming at you. It's not nearly as interesting as to do it blind. And when you do it in a lot of these competitions, and when you do it kind of professionally, it's all blind. It's like double blind. It's like proceeding with science, right? Double blind tests. I didn't even think of that. That's actually a good metaphor, too, the double-blind test in science. I don't know. I think blind tasting is the way to go. And I also think that it's a really exciting time to be embarking on this because we've learned it's really time that we've learned to kind of accept the notion of play as well. And I know all of us are really busy. We all have careers. We have kids and pets or whatever. But I do think that this style of cooking, this kind of breakaway style, is really suited to our times in a way that other ones aren't, because you're freer to do stuff, and it's so quick. You know, you just make these really simple combinations and stuff. And you know, I do think that global ingredients that I'm so fond of from all these countries will become as common as, you know, it's only been 20 years, I think, where extra virgin olive oil was a big deal. I mean, does anybody remember that? Sun-dried tomatoes, right? Those weren't always around. But they came around when I was kind of coming into, you know, in my 20s or something. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. But now they're just these utterly common ingredients. And I do think the same thing will happen with other, what I call global flavor blasts. I mean, the ones from Japan are, you know, the ones I mentioned, like miso and matcha and the umeboshi. And, you know, a lot of people know what shiitake is and all that. But also from... And yuzu is another one. Yuzu's coming on strong. I have two yuzu trees that I'm very excited about. You know, and from the Middle East, another one is pomegranate molasses, this unbelievably wonderful ingredient that, you know, just sort of lives in a jar in your pantry, and you just bring it out whenever you need this really wonderful, you know, flavor blast. It's fruity, it's tangy, it's, you know, it just bursts with flavor. You know, lemongrass, you know, preserved lemons that they use in a lot of Arabic cuisines. You know, you salt a bunch of, like, Meyer lemons. You just pour in a whole bunch of salt, cut the lemons in quarters, and put them in a jar and forget about it. In about a month, you're going to get this amazingly powerful preserved lemon, and you just sort of brush off the salt and chop it up and throw it in stuff. You know, it could be either, you know, salad dressings or you know, on pieces of meat or anything like that, and it just really adds this whole other dimension to it. You know, and there are many more. You know, there's a Thai ginger called galangal that I really am fond of, that I think will become really popular one day. There's this wonderful Indian sweetener called jaggery. It's this really raw sugar. It's very brown, very caramel tasting. It's kind of almost like dulce de leche in a powdered form in a weird way. I think all of these ingredients are going to be one day, and not in the too distant future, as common as the Italian ones that I mentioned are today. Like, you know, balsamic vinegar. I mean, that was a big deal, right? I mean, now it's just like every Trader Joe's has like this really cheap balsamic vinegar. But, you know, I for one can't wait for that to happen. I think it'll be a great day. But, and I'll close with a short quote from a Zen teacher named Suzuki Shundu, who started a couple of Zen centers around the Bay Area. But he just said, he wrote a book called Beginner's Mind, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. It's a really great book. He just said, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. And I really believe that. I think it's a wonderful thought. So always be a beginner. You know, that's it's the secret to great cooking. So that's it. Thank you. So let me explain how we'll do this. So I think Sylvie and maybe some others are gonna come around, and they're gonna pass you one plate, and one plate has four things on it. Okay. So at any time you can put on your blindfold. Anytime you're comfortable doing it, do it. They'll put a plate in front of you, and you'll feel it, okay? This will be a really interesting experiment. You'll feel what it is, and some of them are square and some of them are round, but they're going to be put in a very specific way in front of you. So there are going to be four things on it, and I want you to go in a certain order. And the order is, think of a clock. Think of the 12, the 3, the 6, and a 9, and eat them in clockwise. So start at 12, feel the plate, go to noon, go to 12. That's your first one. All right? Eat that. Just eat it and really let it kind of sit in your mouth for a minute. Don't wolf it down and just don't lose it. You know, just remember it, right? And then once you've really given that a good chance and you've really tasted it, go on to the 3 o'clock one, okay? And the same thing. Give that a good minute, you know, 30 seconds, whatever it is it takes you to taste it. Then go on to the one at the 6, and then go on to the one at the 9, the last one. And then after we've tasted, and it'd be nice to do all this in silence too. I think it's we don't have enough silence in our lives. So I think it'd be really great to taste this completely blind and completely in silence. And then when we're done, we'll talk about it, and we'll open it up to a discussion at that point. So I don't want to just turn this into a monologue just for me. I would love for you guys, if you have any questions, to think of them, and we'll just have a Q&A afterwards, and just have a discussion.
I love this blindfold. nuts, no dairy. I can't think of anything in here that would cause, like, certainly no common allergies. But if anyone has any allergies at all that they're worried about, let me know. But it's really pretty common, the nut stuff.
Can we stop now?
Yeah. You can start anytime. Yeah. And there's skewers too, I should add. So you just that would be able to help. You just sort of slide it off.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
You do.
Just let it sit in your palate. Try to think about, you know, what it is. It's not a guessing game. I'm not trying to get you to guess what it is. But just really examine in your own mind, in your own palate, what's going on. And we don't do this enough, I think.
So this is a good chance.
Yeah, there was a trend a little while ago of completely black restaurants. They're eating completely in darkness, and the waiters were blind. Right? There was a bunch of cities had it. It's kind of interesting experiment. A lot of people sort of freaked out. They didn't do too well. But I always wanted to eat in that restaurant.
Eric.
No, but I would pass the ketchup manis in the evening. But remember, start at 12, go to 3, then 6, then 9. And they all have one common ingredient, and that's kind of the main thing you're tasting. But they all they've been given 4 pretty different treatments.
I bet most people know what the main thing we're eating is.
Maybe you don't.
I have a big tree.
Or I had one. I don't have only one, but I had access to it.
Everybody getting close to done? Not quite. Yeah, if you're done, you're welcome to just pick up your mic.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea. So, yeah, so, up here is the. Well, I don't want to rush anybody. I'll take your time if you're not done. This is all about being slow. Yeah, so don't taste it. That's interesting you say slow food. People ask me sometimes, you know, what do you think of slow food? And I completely support the notion of it, especially like the local aspect of it. But I don't know, there's something about our modern lifestyles that don't typically permit, you know, an 18-hour
So I think the idea of slow food is fabulous, and that you could kind of do slow food quickly in a weird way, like by using a lot of these global flavor blasts that I mentioned. You know, these things take a lot of time to produce, like the pomegranate molasses that I mentioned, which wasn't number one. I'm going to maybe tell you guys that. That's what sweetened it, or made it kind of fruity or whatever. But I love this ingredient. But the pomegranate molasses takes a long time. It takes, you know, I don't know how many hundreds of pomegranates, but basically you seed a whole bunch of pomegranates, and you put them in a blender and make the juice out of it, and that's pomegranate juice. But then you heat it. And then as you reduce it, it turns into this sort of treacly syrup, you know, the consistency of, say, like maple syrup or a thin honey. And it's, you know, that's really slow food, right? That takes a long time to do, yet there is. It lives in your pantry ready for you to kind of take advantage of that. I like this story about this big deal French chef, I think it was Daniel Boulud, was talking to a Japanese chef about stocks, and he was sort of poo-pooing Japanese stocks, like, because most Japanese stocks are kind of instant. And you know, you add some kombu or something.
Oh, should I have this? Yeah, yeah. They have. You can make a Japanese stock by just taking some cold water and putting a piece of seaweed in the middle and bringing it to a simmer, and that's basically it. And then you can finish it off with katsuobushi, the dried bonito flakes, and that's basically the stock. But the French guy was saying, you know, it's just kind of an instant stock. But the Japanese guy said, no, not at all. It takes a good 3 years to cure this fish to get it into that state in order to make the stock, right? So that's slow food as well, yet it's instant, right? So that's actually a really nice way to think about slow food. I think you can use all these ingredients that have taken a really long time to make, yet you can make them quickly. So anyway, did we like the food? Was it all right? Yeah. Does anyone know what it is? No. No. Persimmon. Yeah, it's a fuyu persimmon. There are two types of persimmons. The fuyu is the kind of hard one that sort of tastes like an apple a little bit. And then there's the goopy one, the hachiya, which we couldn't obviously use for this kind of thing. But yeah, the first bite was a little bit kind of the pungent. That was the pomegranate molasses. And then the second one, does anyone care to take a guess what any of these flavors were? You thought it was what? No? Cinnamon was last. Yeah. Yeah, it was cumin. Somebody said cumin. It was. So I just roasted cumin seeds in a cast iron pan and then ground them. And then I kind of dressed the persimmon in walnut oil. And then what happened after that? Oh, there was a little tiny piece of chili in there. I don't know if anybody got any heat from it. Yeah? I hope it wasn't too intense for anybody. It was a really small piece. And then there was a pomegranate arrow stuck on the end of it. So those flavors, I thought, came together kind of nicely in a very, very different way than just straight up pomegranate molasses. And then the third one was a kind of salad.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, nice. And Greek yogurt. So it was bound together with Greek yogurt and sauteed with shallots and ginger. Yeah, so that's a really nice salad. That was actually one of the recipes from the Breakaway Japanese Kitchen. And it had a little bit of mint in it as well. And then the last one was kind of desserty. Did anybody pick up anything in the last one? Somebody said cinnamon, but anything else? Was there? No sugar. It's a Grand Marnier. It was just kind of in butter. So it's sauteed in butter, and then you add quite a bit of cinnamon. So I usually just heat the butter in the pan, quite a bit of cinnamon, add the persimmon slices, and then just pour in quarter cup or something of Grand Marnier. And you got to be careful because if it catches on the flame, it'll go up. Yeah, it'll be a flambé, exactly. But that's sort of the blind tasting I wanted you guys to do. And I hope you enjoyed the wines too. I'm really fond of this Gruner. It has a slight spritz to it, right? So I think the spritz helps really kind of clear the palate after bites. And another palate cleanser that I'd love to mention is pickled ginger. And many of you have had, in sushi restaurants, they give you that little mound of pink shaved pickled ginger. It's incredibly easy to make at home in a much better way than you get in Japanese restaurants, because the ingredients they use for that pickled ginger are basically industrial white vinegar and industrial white sugar, you know, put together, and then red dye number 5. Really, this is how they do it. It's nasty, but it's good at the same time. But you can make a really good pickled ginger by using some interesting sweetener. Instead of, you know, industrial sugar, you can use some artisanal honey. Maybe it's an orange honey. Maybe it's kind of a lavender honey, something like that. And for the vinegar, you can use a really interesting vinegar. You know, a fig vinegar or a cherry vinegar or anything. I mean, I make a lot of just my own vinegars by taking a bottle of rice vinegar and then just chopping up whatever fruit is in season and just kind of letting it do its thing in a jar, and just at the end of a month or so, you get this really, really infused vinegar. I often use that for my pickled ginger. And then you just using a mandoline and being very careful with it. You slice it very thinly, and then you parboil it, meaning you just boil it in boiling water for like 30 seconds, maybe a minute, and then you drain it. And you put it in a bowl, and then you add the vinegar and the sweetener, and voila, you have pickled ginger. And I like to, in the same way that it clears the palate in sushi, it really takes the oils off the top of your palate. And that's why they give it to you, because a lot of good sushi fish is very, very fatty. And you get this kind of oil slick on the roof of your mouth. And so when you take a bite of pickled ginger in between, it really eliminates that little oil slick. But with meat, it's the same thing. But I love serving my pickled ginger if I'm presenting a little bit of meat, I almost always have pickled ginger with it, because for the exact same reason, the oils leave a kind of an oil slick on the top of your mouth. But that pickled ginger really clears it, you know. So, so that's another way to clear your palate. Yeah. Let's take some questions. Oh yes, let's not forget about that. So this won't be a blind tasting, but I did make something else that we can taste as well, and I made something called yaki onigiri, which is it's rice, except it's got a little bit of turkey in it. Unfortunately, we have some vegetarians. I'm sorry about that. You could eat around it, maybe. it's a great thing. I roasted a turkey last night, and it was that sort of that miso idea that I explained before. So you just cram a bunch of thinned out miso under the skin of the turkey. And I had a bunch of grapefruit, I think, in the cavity. And when you roast the turkey, it just really, really does this beautiful kind of savory, salty, gutsy kind of feeling that goes into the turkey. And then I just chopped it up. And so I have these cute little rice molds. They're these little triangles. They're pink. And you put some cooked rice in the bottom, about halfway through these molds. And then I put a spoonful of turkey. And then I put more rice on it, and then I just kind of press down in this mold, and you make these triangles this way. And then I usually toast both sides of the rice in a cast iron pan, and I brush it with a combination of soy sauce and butter. So these are a little bit cold now. They're really great when they're just out of the pan. They're a lot better, but they're still pretty good cold. But they're just a wonderful snack or just picnic food or anything like that. And you could put anything in a yaki onigiri like this, right? I mean, you could use anything at all. So I like making these things. So if anybody has any questions, please go ahead.
Everybody has their mouth full.
I think they do, yeah. I'm funny you should mention that, because I have a young child. Oh, you have a 16-year-old. Yeah. You got to get him early, I think. She's what? Well, does she live in San Francisco? Well, that says a lot right there. Yeah. That's interesting you say about kids. I find that young people have much more open palates than older people. I was recently in Pennsylvania, I went into this Indian restaurant in this little town in Pennsylvania. I didn't even know there was an Indian restaurant. And this local kid, he's about 16 years old, comes strutting in. He's like, yeah, let me try your sag paneer. whoa, you know. When I was 16, we didn't have any Indian restaurants when I was 16. But if we did, I certainly wouldn't stride in and order a sag paneer, whatever that was. But I was amazed at that. But the point of the story is that young people today have so grown up with every cuisine there is. I mean, especially if you live in a place like the Bay Area. I mean, they just grew up eating Thai food and Vietnamese food and Indian food and Japanese food and Chinese food and all of these great traditions in ways that you know, a lot of us in our generation didn't. And so I find that young people are really, really open to this kind of way of eating, and I find it encouraging, you know. And with Daphne, my one-year-old, I'm really trying to kind of instill a lot of good habits early, and so I make some pretty wild stuff and just, you know, chop it up really finely and usually bind it with an egg or something like that, and she's a demanding little thing. I mean, she doesn't like the same thing twice in a row. She's like, I have to make something new every night. It's insane. Oh, my next question. Well, yeah, I was thinking about that. Yeah. Could be. Oh, breakaway cooking for Daphne. That could work. Yeah. But I'm excited about the vegetarian cookbook. I have a lot of vegetarian friends who have been asking for this for a long time. Oh, and here's a vegetarian who wants to ask a question.
So say we're sold on this breakaway cooking concept.
Yeah.
Give us a couple steps to start implementing it. If, you know, I'm not going to do it tonight and tomorrow and the next night, but say this weekend I want to try this breakaway cooking thing.
Yeah.
What would you do this weekend and next weekend and the weekend after?
I would head right to the farmer's market first. That would be my first step. And people sometimes get confused about a farmer's market, about what to buy or whatever, but it's, for me, it's very easy. You buy whatever there's the most of, because by definition, that's what's in season. Like if you see a gigantic pile of pears, you know pears are in season, or persimmons or whatever. And it tends to be the cheapest way to shop as well, because that's what's going on now, right? That's what's in season. So I would go to the farmer's market and I would buy whatever's in season. And I would not even worry about what it is. I would just buy it. Like even if maybe cauliflower, I don't know, because the winter greens are coming on strong. I would buy a lot of winter greens right now. And then I would head to, and it, this, you know, it would turn into a project at first, because you wouldn't want to hit every Indian and Middle Eastern and Japanese market in San Francisco. But I would start with, say, you know, an Indian market, let's say. There's a great one on 16th, or on Valencia near 16th. I think between 15th and 16th, I think. But they're all over the city. I mean, they're everywhere. But and I would just buy a basic, you know, just a basic starter kit of Indian stuff. One of them would be this wonderful spice called star anise that Indians use a lot. Everybody knows what star anise is. And I would kind of, you know, one thing to do with it would be just to saute an onion and just in like olive oil or butter or whatever fat you want to use. And then I would add a whole bunch of star anise, and then I would pile on the greens. That's a perfect one, you know. Or if you wanted to visit a Japanese market, oh God, there's so many things you could do in a Japanese market. But I would certainly buy some miso. I would buy some umeboshi, these pickled plums, and you know, you can make a beautiful salad dressing out of umeboshi, for example. It's this pickled plum. There's a pit in the middle. It's very salty. It's very intense. But if you just put it in the blender with some olive oil or any kind of oil you like, grapeseed oil actually works well too, with some little bit of vinegar and maybe a little bit of sweetener, because the intensity of the umeboshi is really pretty intense. And I would make a really nice salad dressing out of it. And then I would buy a whole bunch of lettuces at the farmer's market and have this really unusual salad. And maybe throw in an Asian pear, you know what I mean, or something like that, or persimmons. So that's the step. It's really where ethnic markets meets farmers markets in a way. So the more familiar you can be with your local ethnic markets, and again, I would suggest doing it kind of blindly too, just because you don't know what to do with star anise or jaggery or any of these things. Don't let that stop you from buying it. Just buy it and taste it, right? And really start to play and have a kind of sense of, you know, what's the worst thing that could happen? Well, you might fail. Okay, you know, you might have to throw away a little bit of food. But, if you're kind of judicious about it and take little baby steps toward it, you know, it nothing bad is going to happen, right? That's what I would say. Yeah.
I understand that one of the people on Earth who have the longest life expectancy are the Japanese.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, there seems to be a contradiction when you go into a restaurant and you see the men smoking like chimneys.
Oh, it's crazy. In hospitals. They're smoking like chimneys. I'm serious. I was blown away. There are ashtrays everywhere.
The men drink after work.
Oh, drink like crazy.
So what?
What the hell gives?
Yeah.
Oh, God. I mean, who knows? I mean, some people say it's diet-based. There's a very high incidence of stomach cancer in Japan, and a lot of people think that's from all the soy sauce. Like, it's a pretty salty diet. I'm amazed, too. I don't know if anyone – my theory, and I don't know anyone who else has that theory, has this theory, but there's so much great public transportation in Japan that you know, a lot of people have cars, of course, but most people, and certainly in cities – walk everywhere, and they walk. It's kind of hard to get around because, well, it's not hard to get around. It's easy to get around, but a lot of the subway stations have these long sets of stairs. People are constantly climbing stairs in Japan, and they're constantly moving. You know, I think that's got to have something to do with it. You know, and I think the diet is generally very good. Although, you know, if you really think about it, Japanese do eat a lot of processed food. They eat a lot of pickled stuff. Which is actually very good for you. There's the whole theory on fermentation, but that's not what's bad for you. But they eat a lot of packaged food, you know, instant ramen and this kind of thing. So it really does blow me away too. I can't believe it. But the highest the longest lived people in Japan are actually in Okinawa, the southernmost islands, and they have kind of a unique diet down there. They eat a lot of pork, they eat a lot of rice, and they eat a lot of fresh vegetables. They don't drink very much. They drink a little bit. They drink a drink called awamori. But it's kind of a mystery to me, too. It's sort of like why French women don't get fat. Same thing, you know. How the hell does that happen with all that? You know what I mean? You go to France, and there's just, like, pastries everywhere and the greatest food on earth. And just like
we do walk a lot, too.
Right? Yeah. I think that's part of it. I really
everywhere.
Do. And portion control, of course. I mean, you know, Japanese, when they come here and they come into a restaurant and they're presented with this kind of American-style portion of something, you know, that's like a family of four could dine on that thing. And so it's that Japanese aren't used to eating large portions. And that has to be – I'm sure that's true with French as well.
Yeah, and I would say also regarding French diet, I think the variety of what we eat, we eat a little bit of everything, vegetables, mm-hmm. meat, and cheese and – but not
lots
a lot,
of wine.
But yeah. So yeah, you have to have a little bit of everything in your diet.
I think so too. I think so too. Yeah, we're very worried about our diets here in America. I think we worry way too much. I think the worry is almost like, I don't know, not worth it. Yes.
Hi. Thanks so much for coming out to speak with us tonight. I got your Breakaway Japanese Cookbook, and I made about half of the recipes in there. They're really great. I really love the innovative like pasta dish with the carrot juice and the
carrot juice is a fabulous ingredient.
Dried mushroom.
Yeah. It's really the dried shiitake that are pulverized. Yeah.
But I've been looking to make that custard tofu that you wrote about. I think it's called Oboro Dofu.
Oboro Dofu, it's called. Yeah, it's hard to find here. But
have you been able to find it here?
Well, there's a facsimile of it that's very good, made by the Hodo Soy people. They're in the ferry terminal on Saturday mornings, and they have this pretty artisanal, organic, beautiful tofu that really does resemble oboro. They call it custard tofu, and it really does resemble like panna cotta. It's so soft. It's so delicious. It's really, really good. So that would be the one I would buy. And I don't know if they're in Whole Foods or not yet, but they
does anybody
know?
I tried Japantown, Najia.
Oh, they don't have it in there. They have an okay one in there called it's really cheap, but it's really good. It's called Tsukui, Tsukui, Tsukui Dofu. And it's very, very soft, and I like it. And it's only like 99 cents for a nice tub of it. Whereas the Hodo Soy one I think is $5 or something. But it's still worth $5. I mean it's incredible. It's really good.
Thanks.
Yeah. Anybody else? Cynthia.
Give us a preview of some of your vegetarian recipes.
Oh, sure. This is the first book I've written with a breakfast chapter. So I'm really excited about some of these breakfast dishes that I've been doing. And one of them is something called triple tomato eggs. I love this dish. And what you do is you saute just some shallots, or some onion, whatever. Just a little bit of onion, a little bit of either it could be a red onion, shallot, onion, regular onion. And then you take some fresh tomatoes, and they could be canned tomatoes as well. I find that the quality of the tomatoes is often quite low. That the canned tomatoes actually from Italy are often higher quality than the fresh tomatoes we get. So I don't have any problem using canned tomatoes in this dish or any dish. And then what I do, I take dried tomatoes and I put them in the little coffee grinder, and I make a fine powder out of them. And this is a very key ingredient in this new book. I call it just pulverized tomato powder. And this stuff is incredible. It's it really lends almost like an instant umami to everything. And I mentioned the word umami before. And basically, it's a lot of people consider it as a fifth taste, along with salt, sweet, sour, and bitter. And it's a Japanese word that means something like savoriness or deliciousness. It's never really a satisfactory translation of it. So a lot of people are sticking with the original Japanese word called umami. And what it is it's without getting super technical, it's a way to detect glutamates on your tongue. And the purest way to do that is to do something that would abhor everybody in this room, to take synthesized MSG, which is a white powder, white crystallized powder, and this is pure umami. It really is. It's absolutely 100% pure umami because it's monosodium glutamate. It's all about glutamates. And if you take, if you go into Safeway or some big supermarket and you go into the salt section, there's something called Accent Meat Tenderizer. Do you guys know that one? MSG, 100% MSG. If you take a little bit of that stuff and you sprinkle it directly on the center of your tongue, you will begin to involuntarily salivate. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. It's the drool powder is what I call it, a lot of people imagine that they're allergic to it, and some probably genuinely are, but I think a lot fewer are than think they are. But you can get this wonderful flavor that you get from MSG through natural means, and one of the ways to do this is through a dried tomato powder. Another way is through dried shiitake powder, absolutely full of glutamates. And so when you sprinkle the stuff on just food, it tastes so good, and it's almost like sprinkling MSG on stuff, except it's polysodium glutamate, not monosodium glutamate, and it just adds a completely different dimension to foods. So to get back to this dish, I'll crack. Yeah, four eggs in a pan, right over these shallots that are sautéing with the tomatoes, and then I'll toss on a bunch of powder on top, and then I'll just stick it in the oven briefly, and you just get this crazy, crazy dish. It's so tomato-y. And then if I really want to take it over to the top one more, I'll take some selgri, you know, just coarse sea salt from Brittany, and I'll put that in the spice grinder with a little dried tomato powder, and finish it off with tomato salt. So it's this intensely tomato dish. Right, and it's all about umami. And the subtitle of the book is called "It's an Umami-Driven Journey into Vegetables." And I think what's missing in a lot of vegetarian cuisine is umami, actually, and because you get umami from things like grilled meats. The Maillard reaction that happens when you grill a piece of meat in a cast iron pan, it turns brown. All this stuff happens. It's like this crystally stuff. You don't get that in vegetarian cooking. If you've ever had an aged cheese, especially like an aged howdah or like a really old Parmesan, you know those little tiny crystals that you see on the cheese? That's pure umami right there. I mean, and other foods that are really naturally rich in umami are soy sauce, miso, fish sauce is absolutely full of it. But you can't. I didn't use that in this book because it's fish sauce. But I'm trying to inject umami into basically every dish. So I think it's going to be a unique vegetarian cookbook from that perspective. So I'm hoping that it's going to satisfy what's missing in vegetarian cuisine. I hope. That's the plan anyway. Yes?
How do you spell the word umami?
U-M-A-M-I. Umami. My friend calls it udaddy. Anybody else?
Which one? What kind of foods did your mother serve you?
Well, I grew up in a family of hunters in Pennsylvania, and I have two older brothers and a father who are really fond of hunting. And I grew up right on the border of Pennsylvania and New York, so they had hunting licenses in both states. So three of them could kill a female deer and a male deer in New York and Pennsylvania. So we wound up with 12 deer in our freezer every year. and they shot everything. They shot rabbits, wild game, all kinds of wild birds. So I grew up eating quite wild, I would say. But back in those days, you know, the 60s and the early 70s or whatever, nobody was doing anything very interesting with food. So, you know, you kind of like throw a goose, you know, some like, you know, some goose that my father shot in the oven. You know, one of my brothers would pluck it, and it would be this disgusting mess on the table, and you know, throw it in the oven. Right, was not appealing. I'm amazed. I did become a vegetarian actually for about 8 years after that. my mother never really liked to cook. My father did most of the cooking in our family, and he was a pretty good cook. And I'm making a little fun of him now, but he actually was fairly talented. He cooked most of our meals, and there were four children in our family. So the six of us would actually sit down to dinner every night, and usually breakfast too, actually. And so it became instilled in me that it's really important to have, you know, meals with your family. That was a big deal. And my mother was a good baker, so there were always a lot of pies and cakes and stuff like that around the house. It was an interesting way to grow up, for sure.
I have a question.
Yeah.
What would you say is the one ingredient that you use the most in all your cooking?
Oh, wow. It really changes. Because it is so seasonal, but I'm so fond of vegetables that when I do go to the farmers markets, I really buy like every vegetable. So I can't really say there'd be one main ingredient that I mean, if I had to pick one, it'd probably be rice. I mean, I eat a lot of rice, and I eat it in a million different ways, you know. So rice is a big part of my diet. But as far as like, you know, unusual ingredients or I think pomegranate molasses is definitely near the top. I mean, this stuff, I was talking with you about it a little bit beforehand. He went to Turkey and he brought back this mystery bottle. You didn't know what it was. And it turned out to be pomegranate molasses. And I really encourage you guys to seek this stuff out. It's really great. But anybody else? Are we winding down? Yeah, one more. Go ahead. Yeah.
Are there any other, like, if you just had to spout out off, like, 5 or 10 of your top things, like, when you leave, if you haven't been cooking a lot, this whole, for instance, starting with an oil,
yes,
the onion, and then that.
Yeah.
There's some of that.
Little tips, uh-huh. Well, the biggest thing you can do, the best thing you can do to instantly become a better cook is to get better with salt and pepper. Most people use table salt, and I would advise you to just throw away your table salt. I find it quite nasty. If you blind taste salt, which I really encourage you to do, you can really taste the iodine. It's iodized salt. It tastes, to me, like the iodine that my mother used to put on cuts as a kid, you know, that nasty orange stuff. And it's got that smell, that iodine-y smell. It really is in there if you really try it, if you get it. And it's just, when you salt stuff with iodized salt, just table salt, it tends to melt immediately. And so it salts the dish kind of like as a whole, and it almost brines stuff. And so I find it very unpleasant. But if you use other salts, like any kind of good sea salt, and you think of it almost like a spice and not a salt, it becomes a textural element as well. Like if you cook, I love cooking with sel gris that I mentioned before. It's this coarse gray sea salt from France. It's not expensive. You can get it reasonably cheaply at places. You can get a pound of it for about $5 at the San Francisco Herb Company. A pound will last forever. And if you just sprinkle that stuff on, you will instantly have better food, almost by doing nothing else. And I find that people undersalt, and we're so paranoid about salt, and we hear from our doctors, you know, we got to really be careful about our salt intake. But really, in my experience, in my opinion, what most of that salt intake comes from processed foods. All processed foods are loaded with salt. But if you don't eat processed foods and you're eating really kind of low on the food chain like we're talking about right now, I mean, you need salt to make it taste palatable and to make it taste good. And I wouldn't be afraid. I mean, you know, don't take my advice on this. Talk to your doctor. But I salt stuff fairly liberally because I don't eat any processed food. And it really makes a big difference. And the same with pepper. Like, never use dead pepper. Like, you know, don't buy pre-ground pepper ever, because it's just, you smell it, and it's like, oh, God. And it just smells old and off and nasty. But if you start with fresh, whole peppercorns and you grind them as you go, that will instantly take your level of cooking up several levels without doing anything else. And also, I like to keep a fairly well-stocked fridge with things like, you mentioned carrot juice before. Carriage is a fabulous ingredient to keep around. I think of it as a stock. So if I don't have any kind of, you know, chicken stock or whatever stock I need or want, I'll just pull out the carrot juice, and it lends a really nice color to things. Like, one of my favorite things to do with it is to make a simple pot of rice. Talked about rice before. But if you take, instead of cooking rice with 100% water, I usually take 1/3 carrot juice and 2/3 water and cook the rice in that. And it turns this lovely shade of kind of like yellowish orange, and it adds a little bit of sweetness and depth from the carrot, you know? And so just stuff like that. So I would keep carrot juice. And oftentimes, if you're cooking something, there's a lot of stuff in the bottom of a pan that's where all the action is. So you need to lift that, all that flavor off the bottom of a pan somehow, and carrot juice is brilliant for that. So if you're cooking some vegetables, just you're cooking, you know, Brussels sprouts in a pan, if you don't have enough oil in there, or even if you do have enough oil in there, there's often all this brown stuff in the bottom of the pan, right? That stuff is where all the action is. So you want to loosen that somehow. Instead of just pouring a little water and scraping it and, you know, pouring that back on your vegetables, you know, use some carrot juice on it, and it will make a huge difference. And also, I find that people tend to not put enough tang in their food, sourness. And good food has to be balanced, really, with salt and some kind of sour, not sour because it sounds bad, but a tang. And the tang can be achieved either by citrus or vinegar or tamarind, if you want to get kind of fancy. Anything that adds a little bit of sourness to the food with the salt, and oftentimes it needs a slight amount of sweetness as well, without it becoming cloying, of course. But if you keep a little bit of agave syrup around and you just add like a drop to stuff, just to take away that bite of a powerful vinegar, it makes all the difference. So you've got this harmony going on. And if you've used some of these instant umami things that I was talking about, like the tomato or the dried shiitake, then you've got it all. You've got the sour, you've got the salt, you've got the sweet, and you've got the umami all coming into one dish. And that's kind of the holy grail right there. So always think about balance in your food. So keep good vinegars around. Keep 10 kinds of vinegar around. They never go bad, right? Keep some good oils around. Keep some good salt around. And just have this stuff available. And another tip that I like to tell people is keep it visible. If you go to my website, it's just breakawaycook.com. There's a section called video there, and it's me doing a whole bunch of demonstrations on video and stuff. And behind me is in my tiny kitchen, which is about the size of this table. And I learned to cook in these minuscule spaces in Japan. It's not about the gear, is another of my messages. You know, you don't need a big fancy kitchen. You don't need to go to Williams Sonoma and spend a ton of money on pots and pans. I like to keep everything very minimal. But my one other insight, I guess you could call it, is to keep stuff visible. And so behind me on these videos is a wall of spices. And I just went to IKEA and I got a bunch of jars. And I've got a whole bunch of jars that of just stuff. And I get so inspired just by, you know, I have no idea what I'm going to make for dinner, you know, tomorrow or whatever. And I'll just kind of look in the fridge and I've got some stuff. And I'll look at my wall of spices and I can see what I've got. So half the battle is seeing it. If you've got your spices in a drawer and you've got to, like, you know, paw around for it and they're all hidden and they're dead anyway, right, because you haven't used them in 2 years. And I really recommend throwing out all your spices. Like, as a start, you know, if you haven't really touched them in a while, no, they're not any good because they're pre-ground too. And another thing is to try to keep whole spices around and only grind them in very small amounts so that they're always at their peak freshness, right? So just stuff like that. You want to nudge yourself into being able to cook on the fly. And you don't want to have to go to the store and, like, you know, hunt down an Indian restaurant for some ingredient that you don't have. You want to kind of have it around and buy stuff in small quantities. And just try to make it easy for yourself to cook. That's the main thing, I think.
Well, thank you, Eric, for these appetizing tips. And I would like to let you know that there are a few copies of the Breakaway Cook to sell at by the exit door, if you're interested, while waiting for the next one. And thank you again. I think everybody must be pretty hungry by now.